if you look at higher education, it is largely founded on the bachelor and master's degree. And the bachelor's and master's degree, the average age of a bachelor recipient is about 25 years old. The average recipient of a master's degree is about 29 years old. And I think that's where the problems start.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is my chance to speak with cool people doing awesome things in and around the great state of Montana. We are proudly underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot Communications. Hey folks, welcome back and thanks for tuning in. Well, it's New Year's Eve, a time when many of us live the cliche and take stock of what's going right and what's going wrong in our lives. I'm really not a fan of resolutions, but I do like the introspection that goes into them. The conversation you're about to hear is thus perfectly appropriate for the occasion. Scott Latham is a professor of management at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's a scholar of organizational decline and has recently focused his research on the future of work. So what is the future of work? Well, it's nothing new. In fact, Scott tells us that we're currently going through our fourth future of work. This one, however, is different in that technology and other forces are threatening to eliminate rather than create jobs. Sure, new jobs will be created, but we cannot predict what they will be. Scott's thinking on this is clarifying, horrifying, and inspiring all at the same time. He's certainly motivated me to take a hard look at the core product we offer here at the University of Montana. Does that product match the challenges before us? Well, I'll let you develop your own view of that. Anyway, let's get into it with Scott Latham right now. Okay, so we're here today with Professor Scott Latham. Scott, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Justin. I'm thrilled to be here.
So you are a close friend and collaborator of one of my favorite colleagues, Mike Braun, here at the College of Business. The two of you went to grad school together. Was that at Amherst?
We did. We both got our doctorates out at UMass Amherst.
And you are an expert in strategy, organizational decline, and now teach at UMass Lowell.
I do. One of the sister campuses of the broader UMass system. You know, I grew up about six, 7 miles from the campus. Lowell is debatably the birth of the American Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely.
It is a Rust Belt type city that has had a lot of ups and downs. I've seen them personally. I'm an alum here. These days we're on an upswing. It's a wonderful city with so much to offer. And it's a really great university. And, you know, I love teaching here because when I look out at the classroom, I see students that look like me, you know, they're first generation kids. College is a dramatic shift, I think, for them and for their families. And so I feel a profound sense of obligation to do what I can and play a part in their development as individuals and professionals.
Yeah, it's funny. On the surface level, you might not think that Lowell, Massachusetts and Missoula, Montana share many things in common. Yet some of the dynamics you described there, I think we have a lot of similarities in the type of institutions we are and the missions we're trying to, or the customers we're trying to serve in many ways.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I've been out to the campus and it's beautiful. And I can tell you that you have a river that pretty much runs through your campus and we do as well. And so there are a lot of similarities, I think, as far as mission, you know, how the central role we play in both the cities and in the larger region. I know geographically Massachusetts can't compare to Montana, but, you know, we're about 30 miles from Boston, northeast, and we play a real central role in high tech, healthcare, medical devices. We just launched an advanced textile center that's looking at smart fabrics, for example. I think we're very similar in with regards to the role we play in our, you know, mutual states.
So our paths crossed. I mean, I sort of knew of you just by following Mike's research, but our paths sort of crossed more formally a few weeks back when you spoke to our advisory board here at the College of Business about this concept of the future of work. And you have sort of pivoted your research in recent years to really kind of dig into this. And it's a topic that has so many dimensions. But I just sort of once sort of touching base with your work, it started really clarifying what's in front of us from a future work standpoint. And before we get into kind of how universities and maybe our two universities specifically can address some of this stuff, let's get into what is this concept of the future of work. It's not necessarily new, but how is it manifesting right now?
Yeah. So for me, let me just walk into, for your listeners, how I arrived here. I came out of UMass Amherst in the early 90s and by luck just went into the software industry. And the first job I had out of school was for a global positioning system software company, GPS integrated software, largely for the Navy.
Okay. And, was that Raytheon?
We worked with Raytheon. Raytheon was a partner of ours. And so we would scan charts, we developed the software, and then we would go on naval vessels and put this software on, you know, all types and all sizes of naval vessels, all, you know, throughout the U.S., you know, up here in the Northeast, down in Norfolk, Virginia, down to Florida, or over on the West Coast. And back in the day, the early 90s, the things that we take for granted now on our phone, it was pretty revolutionary.
Sure.
And then I think I was employee number four. We realized very quickly that while that market was protected, it was small. You know, there's only so many naval vessels out there. Mm-hmm. And so then we went into the commercial area of the nautical market, looking at fishing vessels. And then we went into the recreational market, looking at larger vessels as well, you know, anywhere from about 30 to 40 feet.
Sure.
Because enough, you needed a computer on board to be able to do it. So that was an instance, I think, where technology and innovation had some disruption in the market. Worked there, you know, well into my late 20s, and then left and went into the ERP, enterprise resources planning, companies like SAP, Oracle, and the such, and saw how those IT systems, again, disrupted organizations, and saw the dot-com boom and the bust. And for me, then going into my early 30s, in full disclosure, Justin, I'm a pretty open book. Mike will tell you that. I was burnt out. You know, like a lot of people, I think, in the software industry, you know, putting in 16-hour days, 7 days a week, mm-hmm. you know, probably well from my 20s into my early 30s, it's tiresome. And so left at that point, did my research on the dot-com bust, and it was that, my firsthand experience, and then getting into the research that led me to look at this whole notion of disruption and technology and innovation and the churn, and the idea of what they call creative destruction.
Right.
And we're in an instance of it right now. And that's why looking at the future of work is kind of an extension of what I have seen personally and studied in my doctoral program. And now we're on the forefront of it. And for me, this future of work thing is amazing, because there is a tremendous amount of hysteria around it. And while I get it, and we talked earlier about the pain that's going to be associated with it, it's not the first future of work.
Right.
By any means, you could, any of your listeners or you or I, you could type in industry 4.0 and you would get research reports from PricewaterhouseCoopers, the Wall Street Journal, think tanks, you name it. And, you know, so we're at what they're calling, you know, the fourth iteration or the fourth industrial revolution, the first being, you know, industrial production and rail, the second being, you know, efficient mass production, the third being IT and telecommunications that we saw in, you know, the mid last century. And now with automation, AI, biotech, bio wearables, this is the 4.0. And I think the central component is the whole idea of a job ledger. In each of the past three industrial revolutions, there's been an accounting of whether or not more jobs were destroyed or created. And by all accounts, more were created. Most economists, you know, point to the last three industrial revolutions and think, you know what? Yes, it was pain, but there's been a plus for the economy as a whole and for customers and the value they derive and mm-hmm. the efficiencies and productivity. However, I think a lot of folks are wondering if that's going to hold for our industry 4.0 in this current instance of future of work. And the answer to that is, and I think everyone needs to know, is no one knows. I mean, no one knows. Yeah. I have read, I am as well read as anyone in the field right now. I shared with you a graphic with regards to the U.S. predicted job losses over the next 2 to 3 decades. I have read every report, and they don't know. And so the models vary dramatically across industries. They vary across regions. They vary in their assumptions. They vary in their characterization of the standardization of the occupations being studied. And so that variance is evident. And, you know, you look at someone like a Forrester Research, they think, you know, over the next couple decades, we're going to lose about 24 million jobs. Oxford did a study about 4 years ago out of the UK. They thought the number was closer to 75 million. I think these numbers are inflated, and I give them largely to show the extent, that spectrum of job loss. But what I do say, and I teach a graduate class in this, you know, the worst case scenario is we're going to have this type of job loss, and we're going to need to get people back into the workforce. The best case scenario is we're going to have a dramatic job creation, and we're going to need to get people prepared to be in the workforce. So regardless of the best or worst case scenario, the disruption associated with this is going to be massive.
And, you know, when you're laying that out there, kind of traditional economic thinking is as these lower skilled jobs are disrupted, the economy creates better jobs, higher paying, better, you know, more skill. Yet, you know, your article that I read, your four ways jobs will respond to automation, kind of lays out this deeper way of thinking about it. Two dimensions and then four types of disruptions. Can you walk us through that? Because, you know, it's a simple model, but it sort of illuminated the notion that, you know, really thinking about low-skilled jobs as the ones being disrupted is kind of lazy thinking.
Yeah, so this is I think a classic example of how bias affects us as individuals. Yeah. Because for me, and as I said earlier in the podcast, my father was a general contractor. He worked in the trades his whole life. And I did, probably from the time I was 10 up through college, he would always take me out to job sites. And so the people I know well are carpenters, electricians, plumbers, framers, cement form guys. And as I got deeper and deeper into this research, there was an inherent, I guess, slant against blue collar workers and the trades and people that didn't have college educations. And then as I got deeper into these studies, I just had to question these assumptions. And that's where the article that you're referring to that I published with Dr. Beth Humbert here in the MIT Sloan Management Review, that's kind of where it was born out of, is questioning your point about that it was going to disproportionately affect low-skilled, I hate that term, blue-collar, uneducated college workers. And so we pulled together a framework based on our review. We coded dozens of professions, looked at the existing studies, and we came up with this matrix that, you know, not to self-promote, Justin, MIT grabbed it, and last year we would, you know, I think one of the top 10 cited articles in the magazine, and this is the MIT Sloan Management Review, and it really got an enormous amount of coverage, both in the academic and popular press. And so what it is very quickly is, our general argument is that technology affects not only the skills of the worker inherent in those professions, but also the form in which they deliver the value associated. And for us, that was the central thing being missed, is that in the future of work, how is the notion of value that you create at an economic level, how is that being affected? And on the skill side of things, what you see is that the threat to skills largely derives from standardization. It goes back to the old Taylor school of thought from 130 years ago. And when you look at standardized skills, surprisingly, what you come to find out is the folks that have the least to worry about are the folks in the blue collar trade type jobs with a high level of relational aspect to the job. And the folks that have the most to worry about are ones that are accountants or pharmacists, jobs that we've always thought as being safe are probably not safe. And then it's further compounded by this whole notion of value form. How do you deliver that value to your end consumer?
So, Scott, can I interject for a second? So with pharmacists and accountants, for example, they have a highly skilled task that they're doing, but they're doing it repeatedly and similarly over and over and over again. So those are the sorts of tasks that AI can disrupt with automation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And we're starting to see it. You know, I have two pharmacists in my family. And, you know, we talk about, you know, what we do for work. And, you know, over the summer, I would talk about the whole notion that the pharmacy industry is in big trouble, and more specifically pharmacists. And like anyone else, you know, they have a hard time seeing that given the investment they've made in their own respective professions. But if you look at what a pharmacist does and you look at the costs of mistakes in that business, whether or not pharmacists want to be automated, and at the intersection of automation and AI, we're looking at what's being called smart automation, they will be. And because, you know, you look at CVS or Walgreens or Rite Aid or the mom and pop pharmacy on the store, you make one mistake, one customer has an adverse reaction, the insurance liability associated with that is in the tens of thousands, often hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so not only can an AI system or smart automation do the job quicker and more efficiently, it can do it with less errors. And so
and a better customer experience too. I mean, Amazon can fulfill a script to your doorstep, or could in a future world with different policies perhaps. But that certainly beats the customer experience of going to the pharmacist. Nothing against the pharmacists themselves, but the experience is not a good one.
It isn't. And then there's the other thing that you and I don't see as consumers. So there's two really standardized streams of tasks in pharmacy. There's the delivery of the medicine to Justin or Scott. And then there's the compliance aspect. Mm-hmm. And the compliance and tracking related to the data is already largely automated. And so that underlying task automation, that when you see the pharmacists, you know, entering in information into the computer, that's already automated. And so now using smart automation, just pulling away the pharmacist, it's a no-brainer. And again, over the next decade, you know, more personally, just in supporting that, the framework certainly supports that. You know, UMass Lowell had looked at launching a pharmacy college, and we had consultants come in here. We talked to them at length, and, you know, they said the same thing. And as a result, we did not launch a pharmacy college a few years back, because the job predictions largely relative to automation weren't there. And that gets back to our discussion around mission. I mean, UMass Lowell has a mission to take first-gen kids into lucrative career paths out of the door. And how can you as a college put a student into a career path knowing full well that it's going to be limited in its scope, or likely to be limited in its scope. So those are what we call jobs that are displaced, where the skills and the value form are being impacted by the future of our technologies. We have disrupted jobs as well, where you see an impact to the skill set. A good example here is accountant. You know, if you went into an accountant and they said to you, hey, let me look at your books, and it could be, you know, this or that, right out of the gate, you should probably question whether or not that accountant was going to do right by you. Accounting, by its definition, is a standardized procedure. And if you look at some of the scandals, you know, Enron, for example, now going back almost two decades, these were instances where there was accountants playing in the gray area, and there just shouldn't be any gray area. So those skills are being threatened, but the form of value, keeping the books, is not. So accountants, you know, are again at danger, largely because the skills are only being threatened, but the value form is not.
Yeah, explain that. I interrupted you before you kind of got a chance to explain what value form is, the other dimension of your 2x2 matrix here.
Yeah, so the value form is the manner in which the consumer basically derives value from what you do. So if a photographer is one of our examples, the value form shift there is very easy to explain. It's a shift from print to digital photography. For yourself and I, Justin, the value form is shifting from being in a classroom to being online. Mm-hmm. So it's an important distinction, because I believe that if we look at the professor, the skills that we have are not being threatened. You know, you and I have a level of expertise that at this current juncture, you can't get from AI or some other smart, you know, automated entity. Mm-hmm. However, the form in which you and I deliver it is being changed. It sounds so self-evident, but it gets back to our initial comments around the way people respond to change. I don't know what it's like out at Montana, but here at Lowell, you know, there are faculty that are so wedded to being the sage on the stage. They want to be up in front of a classroom staring at their students. And for some topics, yes, I think that form of value is still viable and it's still needed. But there are so many different, you know, disciplines where that isn't the case. And I think importantly, and we speak to this, the end consumer is expecting a different value form. You know, other instances of value form would be going to a movie theater versus Netflix, digital versus print photography. We see these things around us, but how do they affect your occupation? And either people are ignorance is bliss, or they are actively resisting shifting their value form. Sure. It's not something I think a lot of people can do easily. You know, taxi driver, you know, people still need someone to get them from point A to B, but the form of value has shifted from a taxi to Uber, Lyft, you know, the gig economy. So that's what I mean when we say value form. And so to the degree the value form is threatened and the skills are threatened, you find the trajectory of evolution that your occupation is going to take. And just as a quick plug, and it was in the MIT Sloan Management Fall 2018 issue, so about a year ago.
Yeah, we'll make the link available. You know, it's one of those pieces of academic writing that is, you know, you and your colleague are great writers, but it's just so digestible. And this framework helps you kind of get your head around it. Help me understand, oh yeah, you know, a plumber and electrician, those are two professions that are, in your words, durable and difficult to disrupt in many ways.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I think is it's so what we're doing now with the framework is going out to these workforce associations and helping them look in a more theoretical fashion as how they're advising individuals.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So let's, I mean, you brought up our profession, college professors. Let's pivot a little bit to, you know, we work at these institutions of higher learning, right? And that's a fancy phrase. But this has important implications for how we conceptualize education. You know, not only the value form, but like, I guess value form is the right term for describing how we actually do education. So how are you thinking about that? How are you thinking about higher education and how it needs to change to address the future of work?
So this is something I just finished a piece that's in under revise and resubmit at an economic journal. As soon as it's available, I'll send it out to you.
Yeah,
and this was
do.
It was at the intersection of the future of work and the future of higher education. And for me, I think a lot of folks in higher education are whistling past the graveyard.
Right.
They just are. And so if you look at higher education, it is largely founded on the bachelor and master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the bachelor's and master's degree, the average age of a bachelor recipient is about 25 years old. The average recipient of a master's degree is about 29 years old, although I've seen some discrepancies in that. But regardless of discrepancies, it's late 20s, no older than about 32.
Sure.
And I think that's where the problems start. You know, the problems start there is because that means at 30, a lot of folks are done with what I would call their formal credentialing education. And that is not in line with the emerging workforce. You know, if you look at these millennials and the Gen Zs, and I can, you know, rattle off statistics, but they're ones that we see, the average Gen Z will have 10 jobs by the time they're 40. So that's 20 to 40. 85% of the jobs, according to the Institute of the Future out in Palo Alto, a very respected think tank, have not yet been created. And then we bring in all of the disruption that we talked about earlier with the future of work. I think we talked about it during the meeting. You have IBM, who said we're going to have to retrain about 120 million people in AI because it'll either affect their job by displacing them or affect the nature of the job.
These are people just, well out of college, well into their careers, yeah, well beyond 30 years old, needing a major reskilling, retraining event.
Yes. And so getting a bachelor's at 25 and then your master's at 29 and then saying, you know, farewell, I'm off of my career, it isn't going to help those folks. And, you know, we're starting to come around to, you know, that notion, but you can appreciate this because you may be having the same conversations at Montana that I'm having at Lowell and across the UMass system. Whenever you bring up the fact that, you know, we need to change our credentialing models to potentially incorporate more modular degrees that may build on a skill basis or bring in certificates, someone in the room will say, hey, we're a college, we're not a vocational school.
Right.
So they'll say that in my, you know, I'll take a deep breath. And I think that horse has left the barn because you can't have someone leave college with $30,000 in debt. And there's no debate as to that. I mean, that is an average that is several sources can tell you. You know, we just broke the 30K mark.
Yeah, and it takes, on average, close to 20 years to pay down that
yeah. debt. So if that's the case, you need, and there is a moral obligation to provide that student with the means to pay the debt. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have them leaving school and not be prepared to have a viable career. You just can't.
And so there's like growing kind of clarity internally with some at our institutions that the value proposition doesn't add up. But then you see it with parents. Like they look at the expenses for various types of colleges, public, private, and you know, I know parents of means that are saying this just doesn't make sense. The amount of debt my child will have to take on and how long it will saddle them.
Yeah.
Is there a different path? A New Angle is underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot Communications, two cool companies doing awesome things all over Montana.
Hey, this is Coulter Nuanez from ESPN Missoula, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Hey, folks, exciting news for you. A New Angle will be airing a special retrospective episode on Montana Public Radio this Sunday, January 5th from 4 to 5 p.m. Tell all your friends about it and tune in.
And there are different paths emerging. And the thing is, you're having a podcast, I do the research, you pay attention. So we're two individuals that are actively looking at these evolutions. But I think so many of our colleagues have their blinders on.
Sure.
They don't see these coding academies emerging. They don't see institutions like Western Governors, you know, and their success that they've had over the past decade. And it really is an amazing exercise in change management. You have all of these brilliant people in different fields. And, you know, the funny thing is it could be any field. It could be history.
Yeah.
It could be gender studies. It could be business. And if you think about any of these scholars, they look at the evolution and disruption within their sphere. So history, it could be, you know, looking at how communism emerged in Europe. Gender studies could be about the suffrage movement. At the core, they're all about change. And so how can you study these instances of change and not understand that you are literally about to be part of one? And that's what frustrates me, because the linear four-year bachelor degree model just doesn't work anymore. You know, what you should have is you should have a student come in, you know, learn something for a year, go to Europe, take a gap year, go work, you know, on houses for, you know, Habitat for Humanity, then maybe come back. And then, you know, we need to develop that type of living curriculum. And it was in the New York Times 2 weeks ago, Justin, I can send you the link. And for any of your listeners, it was a wonderful article on the emerging notion of the 60-year curriculum.
Right.
And we need to get there. And if you, the way we're going to get there, there's going to be a midpoint compromise. And that midpoint compromise is going to be, all right, fine, everyone gets a bachelor's. But after that, there are no more structured monolithic degrees. There's just, they don't serve anyone well. You know, the problem is not, and the other thing is, so the faculty, I think, are problematic because they're so wedded and in love with the way they've delivered things. But the administration, too, it just a lot of folks probably don't understand this. If you're an administrator of a college, you want to build a building, you will go out to, you know, a financial institution, and you'll get a bond for that. Mm-hmm. And to service that bond, you'll basically say, our expectation is we're going to grow at 2%. We're going to retain 90% of our students. They're going to graduate in 5 years, and the net present value of that financial stream is X. Will you give us a bond for our new building? Yes. So these institutions are wedded to that four-year bachelor degree. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get off of it if they wanted to. So as much as it makes sense to you and I, there is the mental impediment to change, but there is literally the economic fiscal component that is going to cause a lot of institutions, as my grandmother used to call it, my Italian grandmother, agita, you know, that chest pain.
They right, just, right.
They can't do it. And so the structure of the bachelor will certainly be the basis for lifelong learning, but that has to be the basis for lifelong learning for 60 years, you know, not bachelor masters. It has to be bachelor's and then just a diverse universe of skills and credentials that people can walk in and out of at any point in their careers, depending on their station in life.
As you're laying that out, what people might hear is sort of a threat to the traditional liberal arts form of education. And I don't see it necessarily that way. I see the landscape that you're painting, and you used this phrase before, and we use it a lot here at the University of Montana, is we need to create lifelong learners. Well,
yeah.
You know, to me, that rich form of traditional liberal arts education is the basis on which a lifetime of creativity and curiosity and adaptability and flexibility can be built. But it sounded like you're not arguing against that. You're arguing it's sort of a yes and. Is that right?
I am. I would never, you know, the best, and it is relevant to the point I'm about to make. I'm 49 years old. Mm-hmm. And when I went to UMass Amherst at 18, I was the first kid in my family to go to college. And I was a blank slate. I came from a primarily white working class area of the state. Maybe had met one or two African-American folks. I don't know, you know, at the point in time, you know, I certainly had folks that didn't look like me. But for the most part, I came from a pretty homogeneous background relative to sexuality, ethnicity.
Sure.
A lot of the things that, you know, I think we now know are incredibly important to an education. And the most important courses I took were related to those things. I remember taking a course in the history of Islam, and it opened my eyes to what that meant and what, you know, that a fourth of the world didn't go to Catholic school like me, or church on Sundays. And, you know, that's invaluable. And I remember taking a class on dystopian futures and reading Animal Farm and We and, you know, 1984 and Brave New World. And these are my favorite courses weren't accounting and marketing. They were courses that you would qualify as out of the liberal arts and humanities. And those courses, I think, become more important, to your point, as you progress as an individual, because the stakes get higher.
Right.
You know, as you go through your career, you know, what are the ethical choices you have to make? You know, how do you understand other people's cultural backgrounds? And that is actually a frustration for me, because the folks in the liberal arts, they're just so wedded in the way they've done things. I for whatever reason, they don't see this as an opportunity, and they won't restructure accordingly. When you tell someone, hey, you know, maybe we need to replace a course that's always been in the humanities with a new course around AI and philosophy, they just won't hear it. Hmm. And so I think, and you see this.
And I guess I don't want to necessarily single out humanities professors as being inflexible. I mean, we have inflexibility across domains here. And I see it in myself, too. I see resistance to change. So I think, I mean, I think that's a fair point, but I don't think it's unique to liberal arts professors.
It isn't, but I would tell you the problem is, Justin, when, you know, they continue this whole thing around academic prioritization, which is the buzzword these days, and budget cuts, guess what? You and I are not going to have to, you know, make tough choices. They're not, you know, I'll have full classes to the day I'm closing up my office. That cannot be said about the humanities. It just can't. And they know that. And so it's time for them to, you know, look at the value. And some people, the AANU, I forget the organization, the American Association of the Humanities and Liberal Arts, they just did a huge research. It was effort. It was in Harvard. The president came out basically talking about the role of the humanities in the future of work. And it was around critical thinking. It was around, you know, cultural sensitivity, and cultural understanding, and all those types of things. That's good news, because I don't think we want to be just churning out, you know, kids that know how to do accounting or how to design a survey or how to efficiently design a factory. There has to be a sense, and I make this case in the piece that I was writing for that economic journal, there has to be a sense of, you know, humanity in these questions.
Right.
And I was on a panel 2 weeks ago with Thomas Kokin. He is a professor at MIT, and I want to credit him appropriately, because it was his quote in this panel as a toss-off, but I've been using it ever since. It's this whole notion of how do we bring the wisdom to the machines? And I can't stress that enough for your listeners. You know, there are going to be some really big questions. And the quote that I will often use is that, you know, we, and I used it on in our meeting a few weeks back, Justin, we overestimate the short-term impact of technology and we underestimate the long-term impact of technology. Mm-hmm. I am in Boston, see the AI stuff. It's struggling to get out of the gate. But let me tell you something, in 5 to 10 years, AI is going to affect the way we live in so many facets. And we need people that can ask the big questions. You know, should we be doing this? Who is this going to affect? And that is going to have to come from people that are well versed in liberal arts and humanities. And so that's, it's critical. It's absolutely critical that they have a seat at the table.
And so how does, I mean, in your ideal view, what is the value form of some of those traditional liberal arts sorts of topics and experiences look like?
I think they have to start tying and getting more integrated into these future of work technologies. You heard me reference, you know, AI and philosophy. Thomas Davenport in the MIT Sloan Management Review last year, had an article about this AI ethicist and the role of an AI ethicist, and that this should be a role in organizations as you adopt AI, to basically say, all right, let's, you know, make sure there's pause buttons along the way. But that person would draw from philosophy, from ethics. You know, that is, I think, how we pull in the liberal arts and we pull in the humanities, you know, questions around privacy and security, the Chronicle data, you know, the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is, you know, as you know, supposedly the trade rag for higher ed. They had an article earlier this week, you know, data is going to touch every discipline.
Right.
You know, so how, what does that mean for the humanities? I don't know, but they need to be asking these questions internally.
I guess let's bring it maybe closer to home as far as, you know, your lane and my lane as educators in a business school. I mean, I think of myself in marketing and a lot of the demands for our students are like, hey, can you come in and run targeted Facebook advertising campaigns on day one? Can you come in and do search optimization for our website? Can you come in and do these sorts of specific things? And it occurs to me as we're kind of talking about that, that those are in the category of, you know, maybe those disrupted jobs because they're repetitive tasks. The platforms change and you got to learn, you got to be adaptable a little bit. But if you're repeating the same thing that is largely algorithm driven, it seems like something that an AI could displace pretty darn quickly.
You know, I often talk to people about, you know, I kind of make it like a fairy tale, or I call it the tale of the young engineer and the python. You know, and it's a play on words because what I speak of is, you know, the program Python and a young woman engineer, and it illustrates the problems with skill-based training in higher ed. If you have a young woman who's coming in and getting her bachelor's in computer science, the average time it takes to get a bachelor's these days is about 5 years. In 5 years, and I could send you the citation, at the time she graduates, they anticipate that AI will be writing on its own, unsupervised, but with direction, fully functional Python programs.
Wow.
And that would have been the entry level job for that young woman. So not only will she be competing with, you know, someone who graduated from Boston College, Boston University, Worcester Polytech, University of Montana, University of Chicago,
right,
she'll also be competing with an AI bot that, given minimal guidance, could write a Python program, you know, to design a 3D mold for printing on the internet. I don't know, but they, you know, it's not relevant.
Right. She can't compete. Right?
She can't compete. And so you, to your point around, you know, web page optimization and those types of jobs, you know, that's where the rub comes in. You know, similarly with, you know, accounting jobs and finance. There was a report that came out, and again, I can send you any of these things. Last year, State Street, which is one of the primary employers here in the Boston area, laid off 1,500 people. These are 1,500 people that were mid-career with masters in finance, had been with the company for years, and they were being displaced because they were bringing AI to replace their portfolio analysis skills.
Sure. Yeah. Portfolio analysts, portfolio managers.
Oh,
just
absolutely.
Being displaced.
And, you know, and similarly, there was a report that came out about 2 weeks ago that said in, it was in Bloomberg, that in the next decade in the banking center, there would be about 250,000, a quarter of a million people that would lose their jobs outright because of AI. You know, so as we get into the future of work, you know, those numbers that I gave you earlier relative to Forrester and Oxford and McKinsey, as we get closer, like anything, like a hurricane, you know, the closer you get to the event, those forecasts are going to materialize and be more accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's starting to happen. So the question for you, Justin, and the question for me and anyone who's in what you would call a professional school, what do we do? I mean, you know, as a kid with a, we have a master's in finance, you know, they invest 2 years, they get it, and they you know, get $50,000. Are they wasting their money? And I don't know the answer to that question right now, but I think it's worth asking.
Yeah. Well, gosh, I mean, that's sort of a, I don't know the answers, and that's the whole point. Like, that there's just so much uncertainty in the system, and it begs the question, you know, if you have this level of uncertainty looking at the future,
Yeah.
You have these institutions that are kind of built by design to not move quickly and to rely on structure and process. How do you redesign a university to deal with this uncertain future? Like, if you could wave your magic wand and either start a new institution, I don't know if a place like Minerva is a model you're enamored with or something like that, but like, if you were to wave your magic wand and start fresh and build a new institution, what would it look like?
I do think, I mean, I have thought about this, and I've thought about it from the other side of the coin. And I will basically say that it's a great question, Justin, because you're basically calling me to the carpet. I will say to people, listen, anyone who is starting a university today would not design it the way it looks like right now. No
right,
one would.
Right.
But then the follow-up, and it's surprising, hopefully people listen to this and then they'll be able to, you know, test me, then what would it look like? And for me, it does get down to the whole issue, I think, around, you know, cognitive skills. I think system level thinking skills, so that people can understand, you know, the integration of systems. And because I talked to my classes and you commented on it. If you look at like autonomous vehicles and, you know, retail shopping, and you look at the Internet of Things, an ability to understand the way those systems interplay is going to be critical, just critical. So I think if you were redesigning, there would be an aspect of the humanities that gives everyone a strong sense of, you know, who we are, where we've come from, and where we're going. I think there'd be some skills in professional aspect that would allow for those students to have some careers out of the gate, but it would not be 120 credits in accounting, knowing full well that, you know, that's not probably, you know, like the tale of the woman in Python. You're going to have to shift, and you're probably going to have to shift a lot quicker than you think. Skills, inevitably, they have a shelf life. And I think that's an important thing to note as well. And then I think there's those thinking skills. And then finally, and I see it all the time, I don't know what it's like out at Montana, or I know it's not unique to Lowell, just reading and writing. You know, the level of reading and writing, and I don't know to the degree it's texting or the internet, it's not good. I think there is some real issues there. So, I mean, there'd be like the humanities, some skill stuff, some thinking stuff, and then some basic stuff, you know, basic reading, writing, arithmetic. And I would have it more integrated. I really would.
Yeah. When you're talking about integration, how would you design a faculty? You know, we talked a little bit about tenure before we started recording, but how would you sort of balance scholarly active faculty, practitioners, tenure, non-tenure? What's your view on that?
The problem there is tenure. I mean, that is the problem, right? I mean, we are so siloed. We research in specialized areas. We interact with scholars across the academy in specialized areas. We publish in specialized journals. We teach one-off three-credit courses. That is one of the biggest challenges. And the times that I am able to work with scholars in other disciplines, I was attached with the National Park Service grant a decade ago with a professor on South Campus, which is like the humanities for us. And I will tell you, I was 10 times more effective than if I had just been with another business professor.
Really?
Because you look at things differently.
Yeah,
you think about things differently. But Justin, I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't. And I've yet to see models for that. The Chronicle of Higher Education this week put a big article out about cluster hiring and how you, and for those of you not familiar with cluster hiring, you look at what the competencies are at your university. So maybe it's nanotechnology. And then you hire across the university in different disciplines to build that competency in nano. So maybe in the humanities, they would look at the ethics of nano. In the sciences, it would be how to develop nano stuff, engineering, how to structure them. In business, it would be how to study the cluster of nanotechnology in Boston. And so that cluster hiring, it sounds great in theory, but you look at the tenure clock, 5-6 years, and these young academics are still evaluated on the impact in their field.
Right, very
narrow. These fields, by default, are not cross or interdisciplinary. They're just not. And it's tough for someone who just invested 4, 5, 6 years to get a PhD to basically then tell them, well, you need to play nice across all these disciplines to get tenure. I mean, that's a tough ask. It really is. So I do not have an answer for that question. But if I was building it, you know, and I've thought about it, and you're starting to see these places emerge, you would have that type of curriculum that looked at, you know, just general thinking, some basic skills, some technical skills, and then a humanities component. And you'd throw it out and say, you know, do you want to work across all four? And hopefully you'd draw people from, you know, history, you'd draw people from science, you'd draw people from education that wanted to look at new innovative credentialing models. That would be the hope. It's a pie in the sky at this point in time. It just is.
Well, yeah, but as you're laying it out there, I mean, just thinking about, I'm sitting here looking at your Sloan article, and
yeah,
universities have the core skill set.
Yeah.
Right? That this moment in our society needs. It needs more than ever in some ways. Yet we just sort of like to bridge to the practical demands of the moment just seems really, really challenging.
Yeah. No, I think so. You know, and then the other thing I think that's happening in the academy that's bothersome to me, and I don't know, and it happens across the academy, in the article that I just wrote, someone said, well, can you do a better job of illustrating, you know, the vocational, as I mentioned before, versus the humanities? I don't know why colleges within universities are being pitted against each other.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, for us, these young adults, they go in, they do their gen eds in the humanities and liberal arts, then they leave them, then they come to us. And there are just these paths, these distinct points, and there's just no integration across. And for me, that's amazingly frustrating, because I know my scholars in the humanities are, you know, wonderful, intelligent thinkers that are invested in these students. And similarly here with the business school. But somehow, you know, and the Chronicle draws me up a wall, the business school these days is the whipping boy, whipping girl, and just the trade schools are bad. They're just out there to get skills. And that's just not the case, folks. And it's certainly not the case with our students. You know, our students, you can't invite first generation kids to come to colleges and universities and then not give them an ability to again prosper early in their careers, because it's a different discussion when they get home. You know, that young woman or man, when they ask their father or mother to help them with school, the father or mother are doing it because they hope they're going to have a better lot in life. So when you say to that first generation kid, you know, what are you majoring in? And they say, oh, I'm majoring in critical dance theory. That just isn't a conversation that's going to go well in those types of households. They want to hear that they're majoring in engineering, you know, work, being able to work in a lab, being able to be an accountant, or, you know, and so I don't know if I'm making sense, but right. it's, I think that contributes to this discord across colleges that I know happens here at Lowell. And I know happens across every university across the way. The people in the humanities look down at the trade schools, the professional schools, as being dirty.
Yep.
And, you know, and then we look at the people in the humanities as teaching skills that aren't central.
Sure, irrelevant, know, or something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right? It's just such an unhealthy narrative. And I don't know, we're doing ourselves no favors whatsoever.
Well, then when you think about, you mentioned the bond structure of a university, yeah, kind of dictating how administration conceptualizes the product. I mean, here we have a similar structural constraints, particularly at enrollment-driven universities where funding relies on enrollment. I mean, how do you do that? Well, you could reward units for student credit hours generating, and then that pits units against each other, and it becomes a very sort of zero-sum game.
Yeah.
And that's really detrimental to collaboration.
Super detrimental.
Yeah.
Super. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Scott, I feel like I'm coming up against the limits of your time here. This could be a 3-hour podcast, and I would love every minute of it. What can we, I want to close with something positive. Like, what should students, listeners, people working right now, parents, whoever, what can they be excited about in this future that we're talking about?
I think universities, university leaders and faculty, they should be thrilled. I mean, they should see this as an opportunity.
Right.
If going back to that statistic that 85% of the jobs a decade from now haven't been created, to your point, we play a role in shaping those jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, we have everything that is needed. We have brilliant faculty that study these types of things. So I think this is not a period of crisis for universities. It should be a period of opportunity. I think a few tweaks to the bachelor, incorporating some credentialing around certificates and competency-based models, and I think we're going to be fine. I think for the general folks out there, I think every time I see there was a company that went out of business out in Palo Alto, a robot company. And I laughed because what you're seeing is that, Cobbin Robotics, that's the name. Okay. Cobbin Robotics is shutting down. And they were like one of the darlings of this robot renaissance.
Sure.
We had one here in Boston called Rethink that went out of business a while back. This change isn't going to happen overnight. I do think a decade from now, Justin, you and I are looking at a dramatically different work landscape. But change happens slowly. It happens unpredictably. So I would look at models like I offered with Beth Humbard. You know, how are these technologies going to affect the way I work in my job? Every job's going to be changed. You know, radiology is going to be changed. Surgery is going to be changed. Laying bricks is going to be changed. House painting is going to be changed. Just ask that question and go out and type house painting and robots, and you'll see what's on the horizon. Radiology and robots, radiology and AI, for example. So that's the advice I would offer to the individual, is just getting a sense of how the change is going to happen. And the when, I don't think we're at a point, it's not going to be a light switch. It's not going to happen overnight. And they have more time to respond than most people think. Mm-hmm. And then for students, I think just knowing that a bachelor degree is one step in what will be, I got my bachelor's, then my master's, then my doctorate. I'm sure you're very similar in that regard. They're going to get a bachelor's, and then they're going to get about 20 different credentials across a wide array of, you know, disciplines and thinking, and just be flexible, be very, very flexible.
Maybe so. They'll buy a subscription. Imagine that.
I think that's a neat way of looking at it. Yeah. You're probably going to see that happen. I think you'll have someone the thing that's bothersome around that is I think you'll see an MIT or Boston University, These top tier, top 50 schools will come out and say, all right, Scott, Justin, we'll give you a subscription model for education, $129 a month for 5 years. And you can take any course online in our catalog.
Yeah.
I mean, but there again, there's the change associated with you and I delivering that. And there's that fiscal barrier associated with how schools typically their funding mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So, but that's going to happen. And it's going to happen out of those schools because they have larger,
it's huge endowments,
endowments and cushions and pillows that can support that type of innovation. You're also, the other thing you're going to see, I think that is you're going to start to see a lot more private training. The Amazon academies of the world. I don't think those are good for society at all. There was an article I saw about Amazon Web Services, which is, again, a platform technology.
Right. And we're doing some work with Amazon Web Services. Yeah.
It locks in the individual. I think the research shows that it doesn't increase their job prospect. It diminishes them. When they try to go cross-platform, they struggle. So I don't think we want the rise of private corporate universities. I do not. I think that'll be a disaster.
Well, we've seen on a different scale what that's done to the student debt situation. It's not good.
And then the one thing we haven't talked about, and you know, I'm probably not the person to talk about, is the whole China equation. You know, higher ed's relationship with China is incredibly dysfunctional. And that gravy train is over, you know, for a lot of reasons. I think one, the Chinese PhDs that we've seen come here over the past 10 years, they are now returning home and building research universities there. Mm-hmm. So the undergrads don't have to leave. I think the Chinese students are going to other locales in either Europe or Canada or Australia. And I think there's a deteriorating relationship with China, given the political environment. And, you know, UMass Lowell had a significant Chinese population, and we're suffering due to that. I think that further compounds a lot of, you know, what we're talking about.
Well, that was my attempt to kind of end on a cheerful note, but there's a lot to be bullish about. One is, you know, uncertainty, like you said, Scott, sort of creates opportunity. And we scratched the surface of a lot of topics here. I would love to maybe have you back when that paper you referenced comes out or something, and just keep the dialogue going. Because
if this tends to be a podcast that's, you know, something that your listeners enjoy and you find to be of value, I love having these conversations. I really do. And I'll be out in Montana next spring.
Super. So hopefully we'll do it in person. Scott, thanks so much for joining us, and happy trails.
Thank you, Justin. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Hopefully you learned something from Scott, something you'll be motivated to think about deeply. All right. Coming up next week, we have a true Renaissance man, best-selling author, international diplomat, and now corporate executive Michael Punk. Stay tuned for that one next week. Oh, and Happy New Year. Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. And we're coming to you from Studio 49, a gift from University of Montana alums Michelle and Lauren Hansen. And remember that A New Angle is supported by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. These guys pretty much sell anything electrical you would ever need, but they also hire a ton of our students. If you want to learn more about jobs at CED, visit cedcareers.com. Before we go, I want to thank some important peeps, executive producer Stefan Borsum, and interns Aspen Runkel and Max Gibson. Huge thanks to VTO, Jeff Ament, and John Wicks for the tunes. And finally, props to Jeff Meese, our master of all things sound. Finally, if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word, and be sure to use the hashtag anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.